This is KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to get to the Democratic Convention here in just a few minutes. But first, when California's governor, Jerry Brown, signed laws this month regulating assault weapons and ammunition, the NRA dubbed California the most anti-gun state in America. Well, now, gun control advocates here in Washington would like to join that club. They're asking state lawmakers to pass an assault weapons ban here. This is Washington Ceasefire President Ralph Fasciatelli at a news conference in Seattle yesterday.
We need particularly the Democratic leaders in Washington State to stand up because they're out of touch with the energy that we're seeing at the grassroots level that people have had enough.
Can Washington be more like California when it comes to gun control? Let's ask reporter Jerry Kornfield, who covers the Washington legislature, for the Everett Herald. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon.
You just heard Ralph Fasciatelli of Washington Ceasefire say that Washington Democrats, Democratic politicians, are out of touch with what the people want. First of all, is that true?
I don't know if that's a good, accurate characterization. The last 2 years, including earlier this year, Democrats in the House and last year in the Senate introduced bills that would ban assault weapons and limit the sale of weapons that have large ammunition magazines. So legislation has been introduced, but the politics of the legislature and the state just haven't enabled the success on those bills.
What do you mean the politics haven't enabled the success?
Well, you've got a Republican-controlled Senate, and it's very evenly divided in the state House and potentially Republican-controlled next year, and there's just not a majority of votes in both the two caucuses to move significant gun control legislation to the governor's desk. I mean, the governor would sign it if it reached it, I believe, but it hasn't reached that, hasn't been able to succeed. In 2014, then, a group formed, Alliance for Gun Responsibility, and they raised $10.5 million, and they put an initiative on the ballot that passed, and that was the background check measure. That same group has raised $3 million and putting another initiative on the ballot this year. So I think what's going to happen is this fight is going to be fought on the ballot rather than the legislature.
And do you think the Washington citizens would pass an assault weapons ban? They're ready to this year, I guess maybe next year?
Yeah, I think 2017 at the soonest, mm-hmm. 2018 might be more likely. I don't know if an assault weapons ban can get through with voter approval. I think other elements and bills that were signed by the governor in California might. I mean, limiting the possession of ammunition magazines that hold more than 10 bullets, that might work. They also are requiring background checks for people who buy ammunition in California. And one thing to remember about California, they have a governor who's a Democrat. They have a legislature that's controlled by Democrats. So politically, it's a easier hurdle to move through. And the legislature there passed 12 bills, and the governor vetoed 6 of them. So it's not a sure thing.
But even outside the legislature, you're saying it's not a sure thing that Washington citizens would pass an assault weapons ban. What's different between California and Washington here?
Well, in this case, I mean, California, what they did it legislatively, and so they didn't have to go to the ballot. And mm-hmm. when you get to a ballot fight, it's hard for me to predict what the situation will be in 2017 or 2018, the climate. It'll be a lot of money. The majority of voters, I think polling shows, would like to see the sale of assault weapons banned here and in a lot of states. The public doesn't see a need for those to be readily available on the private market. But when you get to it just depends on whether the National Rifle Association and other groups are willing to spend money to fight against the ban or not. And they may not care. I mean, some issues arise in Washington, and the organizations say, we're not going to worry, whether it's the marijuana initiative or gay rights or gay marriage. There's been less outside money brought in some of those measures. So maybe they let Washington have a ban on assault weapons and worry about it elsewhere.
Well, are we missing a story here about changing public opinion? For example, I noticed at this Democratic convention, gun control's all over the place where you didn't hear anything about it 4 years ago at the Democratic convention.
Right, and some of it is just these tragedies that have happened in Orlando and the nightclub in Dallas with the police. And the shootings overseas. I think people, it's back in front of them that these guns are readily available and individuals are getting them and using them to cause great harm. I think it also will raise questions and lead the legislation on mental health and social services to try to detect when an individual shouldn't have a gun and prevent more people from getting guns if they are dealing with potential violence and mental illness.
What is something you think could pass the legislature or an initiative process in Washington State? You mentioned limiting ammunition magazines, background checks to buy ammunition. Is that more possible than an assault weapons ban here?
I think when you get to legislature so evenly divided as Washington's will be in 2017, and when they're not talking about school funding issues and budgets, possibly a bill that just says, look, we already require background checks on the sale of guns. Now, if you want to get buy ammunition and a large quantity of ammunition, we want to have a background check on you, because I could go buy ammunition and not have a gun, and they would not do a background check on me. So, yeah, I could see something like that being debated and possibly passed in the legislature.
Okay, finally, let's talk a little strategy, Jerry. The Washington ceasefire says that they want to build a wall, a West Coast wall, along with Oregon and California, to sort of be a national model for gun regulations. Does that sound like an effective plan?
Well, I think symbolically it sounds, it may be possible to unite with other states, but I personally find the word, the use of the word wall might be an unfortunate use in this strategy, because the notion of a wall is so prominent in the presidential debate and about keeping people out. And so many of the Democratic lawmakers who are fighting against a wall against immigrants are going to be hard-pressed to want to support a wall on weapons. I think they'll want to probably change the lexicon of their strategy.
Yes, we may have a messaging issue there to think about. That's reporter Jerry Kornfield, who covers the Washington legislature for the Everett Herald. It's always good to talk with you, Jerry. Thank you.
So, thank you.
We've been discussing the odds of an assault weapons ban passing either by legislation or by initiative here in Washington State, as Washington ceasefire would like to happen. They held that news conference yesterday in Seattle. More to come here on KUOW on the record as we cover the news for you, the convention and more. Stay tuned. Okay, on the record, let's go to Philadelphia now, where tonight is the big night with Hillary Clinton taking the stage at the convention to formally accept the nomination. KOW's David Hyatt has been asking delegates from Washington State how they feel about the moment.
Meryl Streep is pretty excited about it. Hillary Clinton's not the first woman to run for president. Victoria Woodhull did that back in 1872 on the Equal Rights Party ticket with Frederick Douglass. Since then, a number of women have done it, but Hillary Clinton is the first to be nominated by a major political party. And that's a big deal for a number of women here in Philadelphia from Washington State, women like Myra Gambert.
I just kind of press my heart because it's a lifelong dream for me that we should see a woman as the leader of our larger community in the United States.
Myra Gamberg is here for Hillary Clinton as an alternate delegate, and she's 84 years old.
When I was younger, women were supposed to be at home. Their husbands were supposed to take care of them, and they did charity work. You know how long it took me to get into business? I was 60. I think I was 62 years old. That's how long it took me.
Washington State Senator Patty Murray, who is speaking tonight, also takes this moment personally.
You know, when I came into the United States Senate in 1992, there had only been two women senators before. The year I was elected, we became six women senators. So a lot of men still are today.
But if Hillary Clinton is elected, what difference will that really make?
What I know is that when women are in the room, we bring the issues forward that families expect us to talk about, whether it's education or healthcare or transportation or childcare or equal pay. These are issues people are talking about. And what we will know after this election is that we got somebody in the White House absolutely focused on that.
That experience and that message resonates with Hillary delegate Pam Eakes.
44 years ago, I marched for the Equal Rights Amendment. We were making 41 cents on the dollar. Now it's 79 cents. That's over 44 years.
Eakes actually marched in disguise for the Equal Rights Amendment. At the time, she was an account executive at a major ad firm. But she felt being a known feminist could put her career in jeopardy. And she sees Hillary's nomination as another historic moment.
It's going to make a huge difference in our national leadership. I expect that we'll have more women engaged in public service and in government because they can now. We only have 20% of members of Congress and we're 52% that are women and we're 52% of the population.
Eek says millennial women who know their history also get why this nomination is such a big deal.
Those that haven't studied it, that have just been bequeathed a lot of things that others have worked so hard and even died to get the vote for women, I'm not sure they fully grasp the responsibility.
Jessica Beckett is here as a Bernie delegate. She says she gets it. She definitely felt the love out on the floor when Hillary Clinton was nominated.
I could really, really sense the pride and happiness, especially from a lot of the speakers. Like, it means so much to so many women to see this. And I could see that around the room, you know. Hillary wasn't my first choice in candidate, but I know how much she means to so many people. And it was special to witness that.
But a lot of the millennials here do see the feminist movement through a different lens. Varisha Khan is a UW student and a Bernie delegate. She has an expansive view of feminism.
As an American Muslim woman, it's important for me to see progress towards the direction of being inclusive towards women, towards Muslims, American Muslims, and people of all genders, of all races and ethnicities and colors. And I think this is a step in a positive direction.
One thing women here of all generations seem to agree on, that the next step on history's path for women in American politics comes tonight when Hillary Clinton officially accepts the Democrats' nomination to be President of the United States. In Philadelphia, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
And of course, you'll be able to hear Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech tonight live on KUOW. We bring you live coverage from Philadelphia beginning at 6 o'clock tonight. Hope you can join us. I listened to Barack Obama on the way back from my son's little chess class, and we listened, and he asked questions, and after a while he was quiet, and I turned Barack Obama down a little bit and said, "Alex, is this interesting to you? Is it boring?" He said, "Interesting, turn it up." So we kept listening to politics last night. You'll hear it live on KUOW this evening. The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. If you have been in the Seattle store of the international clothing seller Zara lately, you might have wondered, is that company giving a little nod to a local artist? Because there's a pair of shorts sold at a lot of Zara stores that features a design very similar to a design by Seattle artist Michael Heck. But Heck says the store copied his design without his permission, and he is not alone. Several independent artists claim their designs were stolen by the Spain-based retailer. But even in the face of a boycott by consumers, Zara officials say they have done nothing wrong. Professor Zar Saeed teaches tort law, copyright law, and advertising at the University of Washington. She told me that to her it's obvious that Zara copied those designs.
I think so. I think it's unquestionably copied.
Yeah. So then why is this not an open and shut legal case against Zara?
Well, I don't know that there's no legal case, but the reason why it's not clear that there's definitely a legal case is that copyright and actually trademark law both permit a certain amount of copying. So if artists in the market want to protect themselves against copying, they've got to take certain steps. In this case, what we see is that Zara copied a bunch of pieces of art, a bunch of artworks, some of which seem pretty clearly not copyrightable. Like a little lipstick sculpture is not something that there's going to be a copyright in, because otherwise nobody could create little works of art that look like lipstick, right?
Why is a lipstick sculpture just an idea and not an expression of an idea?
Perhaps the better way to understand what the idea expression dichotomy or doctrine does is to prevent ideas, which we think of as promoting progress, from being monopolized by a single author or artist. We don't want artists who want to depict lipstick to have to seek permission from one person who depicts a piece of lipstick or a lipstick tube in a little piece of art. Right now we have everyone has to write to Tuesday Basson or some other wonderful independent artist to seek permission.
Tuesday Basson's one of the artists who was angry about getting copied by Zara.
Exactly. And some of her works actually look to me like maybe there is some amount of copyrightability in it, but it's a tricky question.
Okay, so the big picture here, are you saying, Professor, that a giant clothing company can obviously copy an artist's idea and they might get away with it? And the law is working the way it's supposed to?
That's exactly right.
That's it. But it feels wrong.
It feels wrong. It's a place where the legal regime does not track intuitions for a lot of people. And once you start to dig into why the legal regime is set up the way it is, much of it is driven by the idea that consumers are better off with more lipstick sculptures, right? We're better off with more choices, with more fast fashion, and worse off if independent designers are able to lock up forms of expression, building blocks for future works that will then prevent the progress of follow-on authors or artists.
Is there any sign that Zara, the clothing maker, is going to get such a black eye that they'll live to regret it in the court of public opinion and when it comes down to money?
I mean, I got to say, their Facebook page looks like it's really taking a hit. Every day, comments on there just blasting them. And I think that points to one of the most important lessons here, which is that you might be able to get away with something in the court of law, but not be able to get away with it in the court of public opinion. If you look at how outraged everybody was about Melania Trump's lifting of Michelle Obama's speech material, right? Mm-hmm. That was a place where it seemed a lot was copied. And yet, for a number of reasons, probably copyright law wouldn't be the right place to deal with that. It's the public shaming and the airing of it. And if you can make the jump to this context to say there are places where copyright law isn't the proper tool, but reputational harms and pressures where a market that cares about its fans and its consumers really is responsive to pressures, I think that's an analogy that might help people understand the difference between what law provides versus norms of business behavior that we want to encourage and reward.
That's Professor Zara Said, who teaches tort law and copyright law and advertising at the University of Washington. Judge for yourself, okay? We're tweeting out a link to some side-by-side comparisons of the artist's designs and Zara's version. That's at KUOW. Now, let's talk more about art, local and not, in her ongoing series, Art of Our City. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman has introduced us to so many local artists. Today, we meet an Ohio man with strong ties to Seattle.
Lawrence Brownlee grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, one of six kids in a solid blue-collar family. Brownlee calls himself a regular Joe.
Anyone who wants to talk football with me, I am a rabid Ohio State football fan and also Pittsburgh Steelers. I'm that guy.
A regular Joe who just happens to have a special talent. Lawrence Brownlee is one of the world's leading bel canto tenors. He's known for the range and virtuosity of his voice, the ability to hit and sustain the high notes. His four-year-old daughter knows Brownlee does something most other dads can't.
She likes to make fun of me. She'll say, "Yeah, my daddy, when he sings, he goes, oh."
As a kid, Brownlee didn't know much about opera. But one day, after Brownlee sang in a high school concert, a man told him his voice was something special.
I thought, what? Are you nuts? I don't want to be an opera singer. I was just kidding around. I was just playing.
But he was intrigued, and ultimately he pursued a musical career. Brownlee admits he's not your traditional opera singer. He's short, and he's African American. Some opera companies didn't see him as leading man material. Brownlee used his voice to convince them.
If people saw me and said, this was not my idea, it's my responsibility, or it was my goal to try to convince them by what I did from a musical standpoint.
16 years ago, Seattle Opera chose Brownlee to be in its Young Artist program. Now the tenor performs in the world's most famous opera houses, Paris, Milan's La Scala, the Met in New York City. But when Seattle Opera calls, Lawrence Brownlee answers.
They saw something in me that they wanted to promote, that they wanted to invest in. And so I come back to Seattle often because for me, it's home.
That's The Art of Our City. From South Lake Union, I'm Marcy Silman.
And you can see video of Lawrence Brownlee singing by going to our website, KUOW.org. You will find more of Marcy's art stories on social media with the hashtag Art of Our City. I'm Bill Radke. Now let's capture a cultural moment that just happened in Seattle today. Dick's Drive-Ins. Our local burger and fry institution has been cash only for 62 years. They don't care how long you waited in that line in Wallingford or Queen Anne or Capitol Hill or Edmonds. You better borrow some cash from the guy behind you you've been chatting with because we do not take Visa. That's no more. Today, Dick's announced they will accept credit cards by September. Now, that might feel like a small loss of local culture to you, but the president of Dick's Drive-In, Jim Spady, says, first of all, customers have been asking for it. And who uses cash anyway? Quote, the only reason people still carry cash in the city is to eat at Dick's Drive-In. And now you don't have to make that decision. It is unclear whether Dick's is going to charge you a fee for transactions less than $5. Because it's really easy to spend less than $5 at Dick's. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Washington State delegates shouted down the former CIA director, Leon Panetta, last night at the Democratic Convention. They joined Bernie delegates from Oregon in a protest that briefly interrupted the night's program, shouting, "No more war."
Only today, let me point out something that just happened today.
Among the protesters was Nick Webinanathan, a Bernie delegate from Seattle.
I thought it was a very positive message in the sense that it's an issue-based message. It's not, you know, a personal attack. It's not a denigration. It's really a statement of the people's perspective when it comes to this issue. And so we joined them in that chant, at which point the house lights went down over the Oregon delegation. Some ingenious people over there actually lifted their cell phones and got their flashes going so that they could still be seen, and this kind of caused the lights to come back on, and we joined them in that chant. So we were, you know, in solidarity with Oregon, at which point we got some direction from a coordinator that if we continued in the chant, we would be removed from the building.
So were they trying to kind of shut down the protest then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, the DNC is a four-day stage commercial that is designed specifically to make a nominee look as attractive as possible, and any voice of dissent is treated with a certain level of concern. And I think it's unfortunate because I came to the Democratic National Convention to convene as a delegate. I expected to have conversation with my other delegates and to participate in the democratic process.
I mean, with these kind of protests last night, knowing that you want your voice heard, what's the main message that you want to get across?
Well, we're concerned, you know, as Bernie Sanders supporters, as progressives, we're concerned with the level of almost dismissal or animosity even that we've seen from the mainstream Democratic Party. You know, even an olive branch like Elizabeth Warren would have been okay, you know, we understand where you're coming from, you're not going to get Bernie, but we're going to moving in a progressive direction. Instead, we get a VP pick who's for bank deregulation, who's had anti-women's choice rhetoric in the past. I mean, these kind of things we really look at and say, wow, do you care about bringing in Bernie Sanders supporters at all? So, you know, we wanted to make that message heard, and that's what we did.
What's next for the Bernie movement?
Well, our revolution is the hashtag that came out of Bernie's meetings with his delegates this week. And what that's about is really getting us together and saying the political revolution is not about one election. It's about many elections. And so we've got a new thing called Brand New Congress coming out where we're looking at 2018. We're looking at fielding congressional candidates and building up support for a progressive network all over the country and looking at progressives down ballots when it comes to precinct committee officers, when it comes to city councils, when it comes to all sorts of positions, that we can field viable candidates in. So that's what's next. I'm really going to be focusing on spreading progressive power throughout the country, and especially in Washington. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for viable progressives to really shake things up.
That's Nick Wabenonathan, a Bernie Sanders delegate from Seattle, speaking from Philadelphia to KUOW's Emily Fox. Is that discord at the Democratic Convention too much? Is it too much disunity? This week at the convention in Philadelphia, we heard Bernie Sanders supporters booing and chanting Bernie any time Hillary's name was mentioned, and comedian Sarah Silverman took them to task.
Hillary.
You're being ridiculous. The Republican convention had its disunity, too, last week.
Stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz getting some cheers, but also plenty of boos, as he did not endorse Donald Trump at the Republican convention. So we've heard all this discussion about how there needs to be unity, or that there shouldn't be unity. We've heard this from both parties. University of Washington history professor Margaret O'Mara told me that this disunity is really not that big a deal.
And it pales in comparison to the conventions of, you know, 9 decades ago, where you had, first of all, the conventions were where the nominee was decided, and often it was a really, floor fights were literal.
Yeah, it's not an ad, it's a convening of a complex party.
That's right. There was the 1912 Democratic Convention that took 46 ballots to nominate Woodrow Wilson, and they weren't even the party in disarray that year. The Republicans were fighting between whether Teddy Roosevelt or incumbent William Howard Taft would get the nod, and eventually Roosevelt breaks off because he doesn't get the nomination and runs as a third-party candidate. And then there's 1924, the Democrats. You want to know how long that convention lasted?
How long?
16 days. Took 103 ballots to get their nominee. There were fistfights on the floor, and the big fight was over a big issue, and a big presence at the convention was the Ku Klux Klan. The nickname for this convention went on to be the Klan Bake, because there was the Klan's favored candidate. There was Al Smith, the Catholic from New York. And then the two of them were duking it out so long that neither of them ended up getting the nomination. It went to another guy that from West Virginia that no one was even thinking of at the beginning. So when I hear these narratives about disunity, it's not nothing like the old days.
Well, how did we get from the old days to convention as advertisement for how unified and happy we are?
Television and rule changes. 1968 was a turning point. So people may remember the Democrats in 1968. If you want to talk about disunity.
Chicago,
inside, outside. That's when Mayor Daley's police are beating up the young protesters outside. And inside on the floor, it was almost as bad. It was getting physical. It was, no one could be heard above the din. I was interested to see the RNC put out a little blurb last earlier this week on Democratic disunity at the convention. It reminded me of a campaign ad that Richard Nixon's campaign put together very effectively that used clips from the 1968 Democratic Convention to show what chaos the Dems were in.
So you say it's television that gave us the Kumbaya convention?
Well, yeah, because what the killer thing in 1968 was that all of this was broadcast on network TV, inside and outside what was going on in Chicago. It was just a PR disaster for the Democrats. And it was happening at a time when both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party were changing pretty profoundly in their demographics and their constituencies. And so coming into the 1970s, the Democratic Party changed its rules to become more inclusive, to give blacks, Latinos, women other liberal interest groups and young people a bigger stake in and presence in the election and in the convention. And we still see that present in Philadelphia this week. But of course, these rule changes in television didn't make contention go away. In 1992, when Bill Clinton was nominated, it's remembered as a hugely successful media event for the Clinton campaign, something that launches Clinton-Gore onto its sort of summer of glory and the bus tour. But what's forgotten is the first couple of days were – a lot of it was dominated by Californians and other supporters of Jerry Brown, who had run for president that same year and who were making the same sort of noises on the convention floor as the Sanders supporters have been this year.
Let's get back to the booing. Because that's been hovering over both conventions. They booed. I can't believe they booed. You know, what is better for democracy, do you think? The outwardly peaceful media event convention or the let your passion and dissension show convention? What do you think is better for democracy?
Well, I side on the side of raucousness just because I take the long view and I see that contention can have results that you and the booing again isn't surprising and isn't something we haven't seen before pretty consistently over time, and it isn't a signal that things are rotten. It's a signal that things are alive and that there's a real energy for change. And And, you know, what comes out of that is, in some cases, a real profound party realignment and reassessment where either the Democrats or the Republicans have had to go back and, you know, do an election postmortem and say, how do we change this? And if it ends in, you know, culminates in victory in November, it means that the tent needs to accommodate some of new voices and that you have to respond in some way to these interests. You know, what's interesting is the Democrats have, in a way, historically kind of opened themselves up to more of that dissension within the hall because of the nature of the party and the many interests it represents and the nomination process and how many delegates and how many people and just how big it is. You just have more room for that. The Republican booing, you know, I think the real sort of resonant booing and the most sustained was against the Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton. And it certainly is a party, the GOP is a party that is having its day of reckoning or its year of reckoning. But it's also, you know, nothing builds party unity like being unified against your opponent. And we've seen that in American history quite consistently over a long period of time.
That's University of Washington history professor Margaret O'Meara. And we're going to talk more about party unity tomorrow on KUOW's Week in Review at noon. You'll hear Rob McKenna and Joni Balter, Zeki Hamid talking about the conventions and the rest of the news of the week. To Sarah Silverman's point, we'll be asking who is being ridiculous. Join us tomorrow. Tonight in Philadelphia, Washington State's U.S. Senator Patty Murray will take the stage at the Democratic Convention. KUOW's David Hyde is there. He's been talking with Washington's delegates, and he asked Senator Murray about Hillary Clinton's historic nomination for president.
You know, it is really a time where I'm kind of in awe. We have a woman now who is breaking the glass ceiling at the very top. I have always gone out to the state and talked to young girls and say, you can be whoever you want to be. Now they will see it for real.
We've been talking to delegates from Washington State, and there's mixed feelings about this convention. Even still, the Bernie delegates in particular say, look, the process is flawed. What do you think about that?
Look, I love the passion on behalf of all of our delegates, both those that are here for Bernie and those that are here for Hillary. And what I love watching is that we're actually, both of us, everybody, the Bernie people, the Hillary people, are all debating about the issues that I think are important and that I think people in Washington State and across our country think are important. College affordability, access to equal economic justice, overturning Citizens United. These are issues that we really join on. And as I have said to everyone, the way we really make progress on this, and what Bernie has said to them, is after this election, make sure that Hillary wins the presidency so that when we get them passed, we have a president who will actually sign these into law. If Donald Trump is president, he will not increase the minimum wage. He will not help us overturn Citizens United. He will appoint Supreme Court justices that take us in the opposite direction. So in order to take the passion from all sides and move it along, we need Hillary Clinton in the White House to make sure we can continue to move forward.
But what the Bernie folks have been saying to us, at least, is that the process is one where the Democratic Party establishment kind of makes its decision a little bit too early on in the process. We saw that with the superdelegate system. We saw that with some of the WikiLeaks about the DNC. And maybe that's not the best way to go. Is there, you know, if she doesn't win in November, is there going to be some rethinking on the part of the Democratic Party about how these decisions get made?
And that's up to the party. I'm an elected official, but it's up to the party. I think it's a great time for them to assess the process and say, how do we make sure it is fair? And moving forward to make recommendations to do that. I think that is a great thing for all of us to be doing.
What's it going to mean when Hillary Clinton formally accepts the nomination?
I think I and a lot of people across the country are going to think about the historic moment that we just had. And that moving forward, we have an opportunity in this country to put somebody in the White House who I believe is tough, is strong. I have worked beside her in the United States Senate. I have worked with her as Secretary of State, and I know she listens, she hears people, and she fights to make sure that people's voices are heard and that we get the kind of country that gives the opportunity to future generations. So I'm very excited.
You've been in politics a long time. Here's a woman breaking a major glass ceiling. But what about your personal story and your experiences with sexism in politics and kind of what this all means?
You know, when I came into the United States Senate in 1992, there had only been two women senators before. The year I was elected, we became six women senators. So a lot of men still are today. But what I know is that when women are in the room, we bring the issues forward that families expect us to talk about, whether it's education or health care or transportation or child care or equal pay. These are issues people are talking about. And what we will know after this election is that we got somebody in the White House absolutely focused on that. To me, that's so important. When I came into politics, there were very few voices. I would often look around the room and go, okay, I got to voice this for every woman in the country. And as women grow in the Senate, more numbers, and as we have women in the White House, that voice will be more powerful.
Washington Senator Patty Murray talking with KUOW's David Hyde. Murray will speak tonight at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, as will Hillary Clinton, of course. You'll hear our live coverage beginning at 6 o'clock this evening. Hillary Clinton has said she wants to offer free tuition at all four-year public colleges and universities for families earning less than $125,000 a year. We're going to take a closer look at that sliding scale plan coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered, starting today at 2. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. Today, it's supposed to get up into the 80s, and it's going to be sunny and warm all this weekend. Perfect weather for your kids to spend more time outside. Does that make you happy or nervous? Our next guest, Lenore Scanese, runs a website called Free Range Kids. She thinks we worry too much about our kids going out unsupervised, and she wonders what that's going to mean for those over-supervised kids when they become adults.
The problem I see is that it is becoming unusual and, I worry, illegal to give kids any unsupervised time.
And what's the consequence of that?
Well, let me turn the tables for a second. Tell me something that you loved doing as a kid.
Well, I loved reading, which was unsupervised. It was indoors.
Mm-hmm.
But I was kind of a free-range kid. I was one of nine.
So
how hovering could my parents be?
Mm-hmm.
And I did go out and play until it was too dark to play.
And so are you grateful?
Grateful. I guess I had fun doing the things I had fun doing, but I'm not sure that it made my generation better human beings.
It didn't necessarily make you great human beings, but it made you human beings.
Our kids are inhuman?
No.
Go on.
But in terms of what we hope our kids get, which is an ability to roll with some punches, get along with each other, come up with something to do when they're bored, empathize with somebody else. All that stuff happens when kids are unsupervised, as does the bad stuff too. But when you were playing as a kid and nobody was orchestrating all your activity or stepping in because your mom is sitting on the bench saying, no, no, Bill, you know, it's her turn now, you had to learn how to do those things. So I think it makes you a good human being in terms of, you know, understanding other people, being able to roll with some punches, pulling yourself together, empathizing.
I can hear KOW listeners nodding furiously.
Right, wait,
I
mean, now they take a sip.
Yeah, you're describing wonderful aspects of kids having fun unsupervised. But aren't you also saying that therefore we have this generation of paralyzed, inflexible, fluttering like a leaf, scaredy cat kids? And don't kids just roll with whatever their generation is doing and they figure out how to figure things out?
I think they're better off with it. Do I want to be another person telling you how to raise your kids? And if they don't have, you know, 17.2 hours of free time a week, all bets are off. They're going to be a cog in a wheel and lose their job at 27 because they have no creativity and they can't get along with anyone. I really believe that most kids, they're going to be fine.
Right.
Most kids are going to be fine. So it's not like this is how to create the super kid or the only kid that can function and everybody else is going to be a drone. It's sort of radical new idea that somehow this generation of kids cannot have any free time without it being dangerous, too dangerous for either them, you know, they'll be kidnapped and killed, or that they won't be getting the skills that they need for to get into Harvard.
Okay, let's talk about kidnapped and killed. Okay, let's talk about fear.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you that our fears are inflated, but I don't think parents think if my kid goes to school, they're probably going to get abducted. But isn't what parents do is say, downside of the worst scenario,
enormous.
Horrible. Upside, what?
A little empathy.
A little. but what's so terrible about a kid being accompanied, walking to school with a grown up?
Absolutely nothing. And I walk my kids to school a lot. But in terms of the fears, what sort of drives me crazy is that we think it's instinctive to just go to this horrifying scenario of what if my kid is kidnapped and killed, but it's not. Let's go back to talking about can they have any unsupervised time?
Yeah.
Right? And the idea might not be, oh, when they're outside, they will automatically be killed. But if you're thinking, but if in the worst case, it would be really terrible if they were, so why not just sit on the bench? Why not just walk them everywhere? Why not just...
I'm sitting on the bench. I'm on my phone anyway.
Yes.
I'm nearby. I'm there, but I'm not really there.
Yes, are really there. But in general, we have stopped trusting our kids to be able to roll with the punches or to be sad or frustrated or angry or ill-behaved or messed up at all. We think that we have to be there. And I just posted on my blog before I came in here today about Verizon has this new gizmo that you plug into your car when your kid is old enough to drive, and it regulates the speed. You get to regulate their speed. It tells you if they've gone outside a certain parameter that you have set for them.
That lets me not hover around them and know that they're in the parameter.
But that is hovering. I mean, is it?
Well, what does the kid care?
Let me ask you a question. Is it hovering when a prisoner has an ankle bracelet and he's allowed to go to work and come home? Is that hovering? Or is that he's free? What's the big deal? It's a thing on his ankle. Come on. It just beeps.
But my kid doesn't know or care.
Well, first of all, your kid would know. And secondly, if your kid doesn't know, that's creepy in its own right, right?
Okay.
That's the drone society. But what I wanted to say is that you're still there intervening. And so what you want is your kid to grow up with some kind of soul where they sort of know right from wrong and they do it and they learn to do it because they're part of society, not because somebody is watching from above like a jailer or a parent or God telling them, you know, you can't do that. No, I can do that better for you. I would make a better decision. That's not a decision you should be making.
But don't kids pretty quickly go on with their lives? I mean, what child is constantly with a parent after a couple of years? I mean, they're going to go off and play with people.
Wait,
and they're
going to
have recesses.
Hovering and schools are doing what you're... But I read a statistic. Don't know if it's right. Don't like parenting by statistic. But it said that 6% of children between the ages of 9 and 13 play outside unsupervised for an hour a week. at least an hour a week. So that's very little unsupervised time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what particularly disturbs me these days is that even if I wanted to give my kid this unsupervised time, it's becoming illegal. And it's becoming illegal for a bunch of reasons, most of which are that somebody outside who sees a child outside unsupervised automatically thinks it's dangerous because there's so few kids who are outside. It's like seeing an escaped lemur. I just got a letter last week. A mom was picking up the rotisserie chicken. Her three children, 9, 7, and 5, were in the car. And an FBI agent came up to her and said, "Ma'am, children are taken all the time." So she wasn't arrested. But it's no longer just up to the parent. It really is the government deciding that I can't know my child well enough. I can't know my neighborhood well enough. I can't trust anyone or anything except me or my GPS device when they get a little older, or an after-school activity, or school, or a nanny, or daycare center, to be constantly watching the kid. A kid unwatched is a kid automatically in danger, and that's not true. So just assume that children are supposed to be part of the world. I mean, we have sucked them out of the public except when they are supervised, and now we're doing it, like I was saying before, even when they're 16, 17, 18.
I agree with you so much. I wonder what's the difference between you and me, in a way, because you have a picture of reality that makes total sense to me, and yet my picture of reality is that most parents, they agree with you, they're going to be around their kid just to make sure, but they're also looking for little ways to boost their kid's decision-making and independence. You know, go in the bathroom by yourself, and I'll be, you know, when you come out, I'll be right here. Parents are thinking about the same goals that you have, right, but they're not as far along as you wish, and that either way, kids are going to be fine. And I feel like I'm not hand-wringing about it. Everything's going to be fine. Is that kind of what you're seeing, too?
I totally am not hand-wringing, because I do believe, like I said, by the time you're listening to NPR, your kids are going to be fine, right? But if you want your kids to feel that confidence and to know that you believe in them, at some point you have to believe in them. You have to believe that even if they screw up, even if they do something dumb or wrong, or even if they get a little hurt, it's going to be okay. You were okay. Your parents believed in you. And when your kid sees you doing everything with them or waiting for them or being by their side all the time, the message they get is that you love them. Of course you love them. They get that message, but they also get the message that you don't quite believe in them.
Lenore Scanese of the website Free Range Kids. We're tweeting out a link now. Let us know what you think at KUOW.